Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 56 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, of course, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I am an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Every 2 weeks, Dermasphere comes to your ears with discussions of some of the latest research in clinical dermatology so that you can spend more time taking care of patients and less time flipping through journal articles. We've got some super fun ones today.
So I get to start off with something that kind of reminds me of two of my favorite things. So, Luke, you were one of the residents in my program, so you know that I actually kind of enjoy inpatient consults. I think they're interesting. I think you learn a lot. And then one of my favorite movies, which is Legally Blonde, because it has The Bend and Snap. So this article kind of reminded me of both of those things that I like. This is an article entitled Stick and Move, Hemostasis for Inpatient Punch Biopsies. The authors are Abraham Abdulluk and Cameron Nichols, and they're out of the Virginia Commonwealth University Department of Dermatology in Richmond, Virginia. So they herein just sort of address the challenges of obtaining a biopsy from patients who are inpatient and we are consulted on to help improve their diagnosis or guide their care. They point out that these patients can, of course, be critically ill, they can have new cutaneous finding, and that honing down the differential diagnosis, which may include things such as calciphylaxis, purpura fulminans, or invasive fungal infections, vasculitis, or autoimmune bullous diseases, can be very important in the patient's care. These patients also often have several comorbidities that kind of cause complications with hemostasis and wound healing. There have been some studies that show that biopsies in inpatients can have higher than average complication rates, with wound infection and bleeding being the most common in common problems. And we also know that patients who need a biopsy below the waist are at an increased risk. Hematomas as well may lead to wound infection, so you have to obtain hemostasis during inpatient biopsies. They also point out the reality of the fact, which is often when you are doing a punch biopsy on an inpatient, although it is not ideal, one is often operating on one's own without an assistant. And so you have to get a little improvisational and a little bit creative. And so I thought that they had a very nice method where they achieve hemostasis whilst performing the punch biopsies at the bedside. What they did is after the specimen was removed from the punch biopsy site, they would immediately insert a cotton-tipped applicator that was saturated with aluminum chloride into the defect. Now, Luke, do you remember how aluminum chloride works to achieve hemostasis?
Of course I do, but probably our listeners don't, so why don't you remind everybody?
So the way that aluminum chloride works to achieve hemostasis, it actually causes the precipitation of proteins that causes a mechanical plug for some of the vessels that are bleeding. It's somewhat analogous to the way that aluminum-based deodorants work for sweat. It's very interesting. Well, antiperspirants, I suppose.
It's not the same molecule? I thought it was actually...
It is also aluminum.
But are they both aluminum, ammonium hexachloride or whatever?
I don't think that they're exactly the same. I think that it's an aluminum salt for sure. I haven't done an in-depth dive on the antiperspirants. Perhaps you could do that whilst I proceed. So they talked about the fact that their cotton-tipped applicators are typically 5 millimeters in width, which is larger than the typical punch used for an inpatient biopsy of 4 millimeters. So there's actually a physical pressure used from introducing that cotton-tipped applicator along with the hemostasis from the aluminum chloride. So you have both tamponade and then you have the aluminum chloride, which is providing that precipitation of proteins plugging up the little blood vessels that are causing the bleeding. They indicate that while that cotton-tipped applicator is in place, you can do suture or gel form preparation to stitch or pack the biopsy wound appropriately. Then you remove the cotton-tipped applicator. You can either suture the wound closed or apply the gel foam. They noted that this was especially useful when multiple unassisted biopsies are being performed, as the cotton-tipped applicators can maintain hemostasis in all other defects as one site is packed or sutured. This technique helps to decrease bleeding, increase efficiency, and lessen complications while performing inpatient biopsies. They do have some nice illustrations of how to utilize this technique, illustrating how they can leave the cotton-tipped applicator in place while they're preparing the materials to either apply gel foam to the resultant biopsy wound or to suture it shut. So I thought that this was a creative little pearl for the bedside. I always like things that help us, you know, in the moment manage complicated or challenging issues. And I think that they also pointed out some of the difficult things that we run into in inpatient consults very well. There's sort of this predisposition for the clinical findings that you need a biopsy of to happen on the lower body, probably because of the intricacies of circulation on that part of the body. And so I think more often than not, when you're asked to do a biopsy in patient, you're going to be going on the trunk or on the lower extremities, and those lower extremity wounds can be a little bit more complicated. So did you figure out what is the aluminum
salt? I think
it's
the same thing.
Is it?
Aluminum chloride hexahydrate.
Wow.
Both Drysol, the antiperspirant, and Drysol, the styptic, are the same thing, it looks like. So
that's pretty cool.
Maybe it would be cheaper if we got them as antiperspirants instead of like the medical grade stuff. But I like this article because I don't like doing inpatient biopsies. I find them a case study in inefficiencies compared to doing biopsies in the outpatient world. And this is just a nice little trick to help make the whole thing go a little bit more smoothly. All right. It's time for a fun one. This is an article out of the journal International Journal of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, and it's called Skin in the Game, Video Game-Related Cutaneous Pathologies in Adolescence. And the authors include Georgia Kiriakou and Apostolos Glentis from Greece. So, OMG, what a fun article. Two of my favorite things, games and dermatology, united again. Plus, I discovered that the two authors on this study were two of the three authors on another great paper that we discussed back in episode 37 called Bald to the Bone, about bald movie villains. So I've got to start following these guys, I think, because they just do some really fun things. So they point out that video games are increasingly popular among most demographics, especially adolescents, but especially with excessive play, they can lead to cutaneous findings. And this is a literature review of such conditions. In all cases, abstaining from gaming seems to solve the problem, though whether or not that is desirable for a particular patient, of course, will vary. So they go through a large list of things that people can get from basically playing too many video games. So first is palmar hidradenitis. So you might remember idiopathic palmoplantar hidradenitis from your residency or something. This could be worth a bell, Michelle. So there's actually a couple different types of this, sometimes called eccrine hidradenitis. So I think the one that most people remember is the one that's related to chemotherapy agents. And when you biopsy it, you find some like funny looking sweat coils or something like that, that you'll have to tell me if that's true or not. And however, in kids, it's often related to just excessive activity, like people who go on a big hike or go for, you know, adolescents who are running track or something can get these funny, tender, deep, like violaceous nodules on their feet. And it's basically from pounding their sweat glands into the point where they become inflamed. Well, apparently you can get that just by from playing console games or computer games and, you know, squeezing your hands or banging them against stuff. It can happen there, too. Palmar hidradenitis, they called it. Next is periorbital hyperpigmentation. Has any patient ever asked you what they can do about the dark circles under their eyes?
Yes, yes, in fact they have. Well, is tell the answer them to play less video games?
Yes, tell them to cut down on Fortnite. So apparently a lot of research has shown that excessive gaming is associated with sleep deprivation. And then sleep deprivation is associated with periorbital hyperpigmentation. So, for example, a study of 1,100 school children in Japan showed that both playing computer games more than an hour a day and sleep deprivation were related to dark circles under the eyes.
You know, I can attest to another form of this kind of dermatosis, which is connubial hyperpigmentation of the periorbital skin, because when your spouse plays a lot of video games, it impairs your sleep as well. I'm looking at you, Mr. Dr. Darbox.
You're looking at him with eyes above dark circles, I take it. this article includes a photo of a patient with periorbital hyperpigmentation, and it has the caption, "Periorbital dark circles in one of the authors, consequent to excessive gaming." Oh my goodness.
Oh, I love
so
that.
Awesome. I assume that's not Georgia, so it's probably Apostolos. I'm probably mispronouncing the Grecian names, but kudos to you guys for that. Next is a condition they called PlayStation thumb. It was first a case report in The Lancet, and it's a repetitive motion injury or an injury from repetitive microtrauma, as are a lot of these dermatoses, really. This one is of the thumb. It shows up as painful blisters of the tips of the thumbs, lichenified hyperkeratotic papules on the lateral thumbs, and nail alterations like onycholysis that overlies hyperkeratosis, maybe some punctate hemorrhage on dermoscopy. So basically just beating your thumb up on the video game controller. And a study in South African school children with 120 kids aged 9 to 13 confirmed the frequency of those signs with considerable higher sensitivity among girls. It's kind of interesting. Maybe girls do fewer things to cause changes in their thumbs than boys potentially do. I don't know. Especially if you're gaming for more than 3 hours at a time, it looks like. If PlayStation thumb is not convincing, how about PlayStation lip? So there was one case of severe ulceration and bleeding of the lower lip caused by biting and chewing it during stressful gaming.
I can believe it.
Allergic contact dermatitis should come as no surprise. There's quite a few reported cases. And remember, people are playing video games on their computers, their laptops, their phones, their tablets, their PlayStation and Xbox consoles. Nintendo, throw some love out to you guys too. So all of these things are made with different components, and you can get allergic contact dermatitis to just about everything, of course. Most commonly, as you might guess, is to nickel, because that is like the most common cause of allergic contact dermatitis overall. Also, you can get it to components of plastics in the devices, and sometimes to just unknown components that exist in the device. They point out that moist and warm conditions, such as sweating of the hands, may accelerate the occurrence of an allergic contact dermatitis. So the longer you're playing, and like if you're kind of stressed out or excited, your hands get sweaty, could make it worse. And as a bell-worthy reminder, to test a device for the presence of nickel, you can use the dimethylglyoxime, DMG, or ammonium hydroxide spot test. Here's ammonium again, Michelle.
I know.
This has got to be a different molecule this time.
Are we sponsored at this point by ammonium? What's going on?
Ammonium
and aluminum. Different, yes.
Two different things. Never mind. I did take chemistry once upon a time.
It's all good.
Erythema ab igni. So I think a lot of us has heard stories that people can get it on their thighs from laptops. They point out a really interesting tidbit here that if you put the laptop on your thighs, you get occlusion of the cooling vents. So the laptop gets hotter and then you are directly exposed to the heating elements. It's just sitting there on your thighs. And the lesions are often unilateral, or at least more prominent on the left thigh, apparently because the optical drives of laptops, which are the hottest parts, are located on the left side.
What? So well, that's really kind of cool to know. Maybe a little bell worthy there.
All right, the next one's my favorite. Yeah. Ulcerative Nintendonitis.
So, oh, they deserve a prize for that. That's pretty amazing.
I don't think they made up the name, but somebody deserves a prize. And this is sort of in the same category, perhaps, as like the old like toxic oil syndromes and stuff now. Like it's kind of historical because it seems to specifically be related to a particular video game, Mario Party for the Nintendo 64, which was released in 1999. And there's a portion of the game when you're supposed to spin the little joystick real fast. And many gamers discovered that they could get even faster if they spun it with their palm rather than with their thumb. And so they would do that, and it would cause central palmar ulceration. Over 90 reported cases led the company to release protective gloves to millions of game owners. Oh my God, I love this.
Oh my goodness.
All right. There's lots of different kinds of frictional dermatoses that you can get by video gaming. And again, they're due to chronic or repeated motion or pressure. So, for example, you can get computer palms from resting your palms on your desk or your keyboard for a long time. Again, that's just pressure with maybe a little bit of friction. A mousing callus on the wrist, where the wrist contacts the mouse pad. Mouse fingers, the same thing, but on the fingertips. Kind of depends on how you like to hold your mouse, I guess. And then there's various lichenified papules, plaques, calluses, and purpura at the site of video game controller contact, especially if it vibrates. Hmm. Some of those controllers vibrate these days.
They have that haptic input, so you kind of feel more in the game.
And finally, can video games worsen atopic dermatitis?
What? I mean, stress, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. So there's some suggestion that this can happen, presumably by increasing psychosocial stress. There was even a study, again, there's some really great studies they talk about in this article, where participants played Street Fighter for 2 hours and then had blood tests and prick testing. and participants with atopic dermatitis had higher levels of various stress hormones and an enhanced wheel and flare reaction to the prick testing after playing Street Fighter. Yes. All right. So the authors comment that raising the level of awareness may encourage the video game industry to alter the structure of video game related devices and make them finger and thumb safe. Perhaps. I just thought this was fun, and as a pediatric dermatologist and somebody who used to play a lot of video games and still just loves games in general, I like it when my two worlds collide. My suspicion is that these conditions are underreported because people might not care about them. The cause might be kind of obvious. And my suspicion is that parents and grandparents are quite vigilant about finding reasons to hate on gaming and put the kibosh on it if their kids or their grandkids are doing it to what they think is an excessive amount. But still, kind of fun stuff.
That is probably one of my favorite things we've ever reviewed so far, especially being, you know, not personally so much of a gamer, but witnessing firsthand the stress-inducing effects of video gaming with Mr. Dr. Darkbox. I can 100% believe the exacerbation of some of these conditions.
Well, these days I play a lot more board games, so yeah. Maybe there's board game-related dermatoses, and I could become a world expert on those.
There could be textile dyes in, like, the, you know, playing pieces or on the board itself. I feel like there's something there. That could be fun. While talking about playing games, we're going to look about not playing games with people's lives and with diagnostic testing.
That was As usual, you are the segue queen.
It was a bit of a long walk, but we're going to get there. So we're going to look now at an article out of JAMA Dermatology and then a subsequent editorial about this article and the topic that it covers in the clinical review and education portion of JAMA Dermatology from 2020. And this is a host of really fantastic authors that contributed to this work. These are members of the Melanoma Prevention Working Group, the MPWG, as well as internationally respected experts on this field. The chief author, Douglas Grossman, and the corresponding author there, Susan Sweater, but also some very, very, you know, accomplished melanoma researchers and people I've personally had the privilege to speak with and work with, Caroline Kim, Dr. Ashok Margoob, Kelly Nelson, and Jennifer Stein, all really amazing people.
You also might remember speaking with Decker Deacon and Robert Judson Torres in episode 52 of our podcast.
That's right.
Because they discussed a more in-depth discussion of melanoma biomarkers and actually mentioned this article. And I thought, yeah, we probably should discuss it. As long as we're giving shout-outs, shout-out also to Laura Ferris at OHSU, where I did my fellowship, and Sansi Leachman, the chair over there, as well as to Julia Curtis, who's one of our faculty here at the University of Utah, and Doug Grossman, the lead author, is also one of our folks.
All fantastic people, and I have to applaud the amount of work that they put into this because it was a lot of work. So this group wanted to look at and try to develop guidelines around the use of these gene expression profile tests in the management of patients with cutaneous melanoma. They did a review of the published data using the gene expression profile test, as well as trying to define acceptable performance criteria, current recommendations for the use of GEP testing in clinical practice, and considerations for future studies. Now, if I was a person who was designing or working with these gene expression profile tests, I would read this article and its supplemental data that's also available on JAMA's website as a field guide to what needs to happen for these tests to be broadly useful and applicable across the spectrum of disease of cutaneous melanoma.
The article that we discussed in episode 52 is also a really good resource for people who want to develop things. It goes into those in a lot of detail.
Yeah, and I feel like the authors have put so much thought into how to help improve the state of this type of testing and make sure that it's used in a way that's additive in terms of quality, not just additive in terms of cost. So the authors participated in online surveys, they convened in a summit meeting, and they reviewed abstracts and data from 2015 to 2019. The overarching theme of this paper is that the members of this melanoma prevention working group are optimistic about the use of prognostic gene expression profile testing to improve risk stratification and enhance clinical decision making, but they acknowledge the reality that its current utility is limited by test performance in patients with stage one disease and in the fact that we have not had the evaluation of results in the context of all relevant clinical pathologic factors or as predictors of regional nodal metastasis in a way to replace sentinel lymph node biopsies. So the value from these tests could eventually be that we can definitively kind of make that decision about whether or not the patient really needs to proceed with something as potentially morbid and costly as a sentinel lymph node biopsy, utilizing these kinds of tests. So Luke, as you remember, we discussed the MSLT 1 and 2 trials in the review episode, episode 12, where we talked about, you know, the emerging data about the continued utility of sentinel lymph nodes and sort of rethinking that paradigm. So I do think that thought processes around how to use these gene expression profiles and how to integrate them with other available technologies and tests is important, and a thoughtful discussion is necessary. The working group favors retrospective studies to evaluate multiple gene expression profile testing platforms on fully annotated archived samples before embarking on a costly prospective study, which makes sense. And they also recommend avoiding routine use of gene expression profile testing to direct patient management until prospective studies can support their clinical utility across the spectrum of disease. So basically, it's an optimistic outlook on the future utility of these gene expression profile tests, but kind of not quite yet ready for prime time necessarily, because we haven't proven that these tests add to management. We also haven't proven that they help us to minimize false positives, where you would have a patient who was told they were at greater risk for a bad outcome but ended up not having one, or false negatives where a patient's told they're at lower risk for a bad outcome but ends up having a catastrophic one.
So these gene expression profiling techniques you may have seen advertised, they're like Castle Biosciences, Melanoma DX, there's one or two others. And I mean, kudos to the authors for being optimistic, but I think everybody's kind of softballing the ultimate statement here, which is basically don't use them. Don't be fooled by the advertising. They don't add much to what we already know, except in very specific circumstances. So what they basically say is don't use them unless you understand them super well and can go over all the pros and cons of the patients, or it's in the context of a tumor board.
Yeah, and they actually make an appeal to some of the gene expression profile testing manufacturing labs to take these tests off of a dichotomous one or two type of reporting system and allow the clinician to have the numeric variable. They point out that some of our best data for risk stratification in melanoma patients comes from continuous variables such as a Breslow's depth, Breslow's thickness. And the gene expression profiles have a range that categorizes them into one or two being low or high risk, but the patients are somewhere in that range. And they point out, you know, different patients might have widely disparate tumors and be in the same risk class, but be much more likely to have different outcomes than each other versus outcomes similar with a person of their own traditional staging. As we talked about, they've got these different gene expression profile tests that are available in the US and in Europe. One of the reference articles they cited, actually, their third reference, is a link to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Advanced Diagnostic Laboratory Tests under the Medicare CLFS. And they talk about the actual cost of the payment amount of these different tests. So for some of the more common ones, the Myriad My Choice DX is $4,000. The Castle Biosciences Decision DX Melanoma is $7,193 per test. Foundation Medicine's Foundation One CDX is $3,500. So these are not small costs that are being looked at here. And so they do want to advocate for the thoughtful use of these, as well as for the potential human cost if risk is over or underestimated in an individual patient. They talked about the fact that currently the AAD and the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, cutaneous melanoma guidelines, do not recommend these at this time. But they do also note that the use of these tests is becoming more prevalent. The Decision DX melanoma test, which is a 31 gene expression profile from Castle Biosciences, that has been estimated to be used between 10,000 to 12,000 per year of these tests being used for the Centers of Medicare Services. And so that's quite a lot of tests being done. If you look at the cost of it, the $7,193, and you look at 12,000 tests over a year, that's $86 million change in a year. So these are not small numbers we're talking about.
So I shouldn't use the tests, but I should buy stock in Castle Biosciences.
Perhaps that is the takeaway. Based on the report, although that would be a conflict of interests, reported incidence in the U.S. of use is about 5 to 10% of cases of melanoma are being tested. They've got similar information coming out of Europe, and they said that a recent survey of their pigmented lesion specialists showed that about 29% had ordered a prognostic gene expression profile test, yet only half of these physicians reported that the test results influenced the patient's management. And the gene expression profile testing also has the possibility to provide potentially information that is not as accurate as we would like for it to be. Now, it also has great potential to improve staging and guide interventions such as sentinel lymph node biopsy, surveillance monitoring, and adjuvant therapy. But at this time, it's not clear which patients should be tested or how to act on the results. And so this was a lot of the substance of the work that they did here. They also looked at the fact that the data that we have, our strongest evidence based out of the 8th edition of the AJCC8, is based off of an international database that has validated melanoma-specific survival for nearly 50,000 patients with stage 1 to 3 melanoma since 1998. And these patients mostly were also staged with sentinel lymph node biopsy. So we have a very robust data set for that measurement, which is not always integrated with these gene expression profiles. There's also the possibility that people are using these gene expression profiles as a surrogate for tests that we have more information about or that we have more experience with, such as clinical pathologic factors. And there's some suggestion as well that some of the gene expression profile results mirror those clinical pathologic factors. So a specimen that's going to have increased Breslow thickness, increased mitotic rate or ulcerations, more likely to have a higher level of risk reported from the gene expression profile tests. And so in some cases, we may be repeating information that we already have. So I think that looking towards ways to make this a little bit more valuable is, I think, very important. They also want to focus on the fact that the follow-up times in many of the studies that have been done thus far for the gene expression profile tests are significantly less robust than the ones that have been used to validate staging systems such as the AJCC8. They found that these sort of different tests have the ability to help stratify patients into different classes of risk, but they also want to talk about that we need to make sure that these tests are actually improving the accuracy of our prediction models by a clinically, not solely statistically significant amount, and should be able to help us alter or pattern their treatment. I thought that that was, I think, very useful information. And also the idea of taking the sort of simplified report and allowing it to be viewed in more of its entirety, including which genes are altered in a full numeric score instead of just a kind of simple dichotomy, might help us to improve the utilization of this test as well as its relative importance in the patient's management. So right now, their consensus is it's insufficient data to support the routine use of these currently available gene expression profile tests to inform the management of patients with cutaneous melanoma. But they do advocate for some very useful, reasonable steps to move forward the state of the art of evidence that these different tests might have. And I thought that this was very thoughtful.
So I have a pretty simple mind. And my primary takeaway was that I shouldn't use these tests. And it's nice to have a single rule to fall back on. They did highlight the potential of them. So the word potential shows up a lot. And I think that that's true. So presumably in the future, I should order them. And the main reason why we shouldn't use them right now, it sounds like to me, is because what we had before these gene expression profiles, the AJCC8 guidelines and so on that can prognosticate people are not perfect, but they're pretty good. And so we're not quite sure what we currently, these gene expression profiles, if they add to what we already know, but we do know that they cost more money.
And, you know, I think that they've given a very good roadmap for how to achieve the level of data that we need to really make sure that these tests are contributing in a meaningful way to patient survival. And, you know, using already available banked specimens that have long-term outcomes data and then thoughtfully going forward with prospective studies may help these tests not only to inform prognosis, but potentially therapeutic choice, which is really the goal of the personalized sort of medicine trend that we're trying to head towards. And so that's sort of the perspective that the editorial in response to this article takes. So we have also an editorial here, Consensus, Controversy, and Conversations About Gene Expression Profiling in Melanoma by authors Warren Chan and Henson Tao. And they look at the fact that we're trying to move towards this frontier of personalized medicine and the gene expression profiling tests as they measure levels of multiple genes in a patient's tumor and may help predict clinical outcome based off of machine learning and artificial intelligence algorithms may help us to eventually achieve that outcome. At this time, they also point out that there are some issues that need to be addressed before these can be really fully integrated into clinical decision making. And our current level of support for these is really not at a place where we can routinely recommend these. They talk about how the gene expression profiling associates with expression of these different diseases that may predict melanoma recurrence, and that they largely assign the patient to a prognostic class, so class 1 or 2 or low or high risk, rather than calculating specific patient-specific calculated survival, so 70% five-year overall survival. And one of the reasons they point out that this might be important is that a 0.9 millimeter non-ulcerated melanoma and a 1.9 non-ulcerated melanoma that are both profiled by the same molecular class would have, by the gene expression profile, potentially the same predicted survival, when in truth, the fact that one is one full millimeter deeper is going to affect the patient's survival time. And so they advocate, again, moving from continuous variable. So when we're looking at moving from continuous variables to categorical ones, we have to account for the fact that we have an attrition of information. So we're going from, you know, 0.1, 0.5, 0.7 to basically yes or no. And that attrition of information can decrease the power of the test and it results in patients with relatively dissimilar tumors being classified into the same risk class. And I think that that's something that I've heard echoed multiple times and have personally experienced, although I don't personally order many of these tests myself. I take care of patients who have had these tests orders, and I want to see the data. I get the report and it says class 1 or class 2, but I don't know which genes are altered. I don't know what the score was for the patient. And I do think that having the ability to integrate that information would be useful. They also talk about the fact that gene expression profiling needs to be weighted against or integrated with phenotypic models. There are outcome algorithms available with reasonable estimates of morbidity and mortality at no cost, such as cancermath.net or the AJCC calculator. And potentially combining those two things could help us to understand how to use these better. They also point out that the landscape in which the gene expression tools evolved is different than our current reality. Melanoma mortality has changed substantially over just the past decade because of molecular and immune therapies. So prognosis no longer predicts overall survival, and these tools, these gene expression tools, were built on the older retrospective samples of patients who were treated in the era before we had some of these advanced immunotherapies. And so a contemporary goal for the gene expression profile would be helping to make decisions of therapeutic eligibility based off of drug response or potentially calculation of toxic effects. And we also have to consider the fact that still many patients' ability to enter into therapeutic trials or be treated with adjuvant therapy may be determined by sentinel lymph node status. So gene expression profile testing that precludes the nodal evaluation might keep the patients from accessing some of those therapies. So they recommend, of course, as dermatologists, many of the melanomas we're going to diagnose are T1A melanomas, less than 0.8 millimeters, non-ulcerated by AJCC8 guidelines. And they recommend that, you know, really thinking twice before ordering these gene expression profiles, testing for these patients, because we have a large number of patients that have this stage of melanoma. The 5 and 10 year melanoma specific survival rates for patients with T1A melanoma are 99% for 5 years, 98% for 10 years. So these excellent outcomes in these large cohorts were not very highly likely to alter patients' survival or prognosis with these gene expression tests in this particular patient population. And there's a possible 12% misassignment rate in this population as well. So patients may be assigned to a risk category that could either create undue stress and fear or give a false sense of reassurement and security to a patient who needs to have closer surveillance. So I think that, you know, these are going to be tools that we use in time, and they're going to be a part of the care of our patients in the future. We need to be a part of the dialogue as to how these tests are developed and used, and make sure that we are helping to guide their use in patients to improve the utility of these resources, as well as to prevent patients from having poor outcomes based off of our incomplete understanding of a test that is still relatively new.
Friends, I know this was a kind of shorter episode than you expected, but we've got to be done for now because sadly we ran into some technical difficulties while recording this one. Devastating, I know. But the good news is that today we have already learned about the stick-and-move technique for hemostasis while doing punch biopsies on inpatients. We learned about various video game dermatoses, and we learned that you probably should not order gene expression profiling tests. Thanks for hanging out with us, even if this is only a 40-minute episode as opposed to our normal stuff. We want to thank our institutions as well. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast, and thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. If you would like to hear more episodes, you can do so on our website, dermospherepodcast.com, which is also a good way to get in touch with us. You can also find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find all of our episodes on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for hanging out with us today, and we will see you guys in 2 weeks.